were married in June of 1965. Now that they were a family of six, they needed a larger place. Fortunately, as part of her divorce settlement, Mona had been awarded a house in Beverly Hills, which she sold for big bucks, rolling the money into the new house in Horton Ravine so she wouldn't have to pay capital gains. At the same time, Lionel sold the modest three-bedroom house where John had been raised. That money was set aside for additions and improvements on the new place, which was situated on a bluff overlooking the Pacific Ocean. John moved into a newly remodeled two rooms and a bath built above the garage, while Lionel, Mona, and the three girls occupied the main house. Mona told him how lucky he was to have independent living quarters that would allow him to come and go as he pleased. Not that he was permitted to do any such thing. His pad, as she referred to it, was a not-so-subtle reminder that he'd been separated from the rest. His wants, needs, and desires were peripheral to hers. From that point on, everything revolved around Mona. She had her tennis lessons, her golf, and her charities, activities his father didn't share with her because he was either teaching or secluded in his home office, writing. John was the outsider, looking in on a life that had once been his. He was miserable, but he knew better than to complain. At the same time, he wondered why he was expected to go on as though nothing had changed. His life had taken on an entirely different cast. The following January, when he turned 16, he lobbied for his driver's license and a car of his own. Mona objected, but for once, Lionel argued on John's behalf. After much ado and numerous debates, she finally gave in, perhaps because she realized having a car and driver at her disposal would work to her advantage. Lionel bought John a used Chevrolet convertible. By then, Mona's three perfect daughters were enrolled at the same private school John had attended since kindergarten. He caught sight of them in the corridors 6 and 7 times a day. Of course, he drove them to school and picked them up afterward. He also kept an eye on them if Lionel and Mona went out for the evening. If he had other plans, if he resisted in any way, Mona would rebuff him with silence, cut him out of her field of vision as though he were invisible. This she was clever enough to do without Lionel's being aware. If John had brought it to his father's attention, he'd have been written off as paranoid or oversensitive. Lionel would have repeated it all to Mona, and she would have doubled the penalties. Lionel would have had to be a fool not to pick up on the chill in the air. But since neither Mona nor John would discuss the situation, his father was no doubt delighted to ignore the problem. One Saturday afternoon, Mona took the girls shopping, and Lionel walked out to the garage and knocked on John's door. John hollered out, "It's open!" and Lionel dutifully trudged up the stairs. He took a moment to survey the place, which was as cold and bare as a cell. He said, "Well, it looks like you've settled in. Very nice. Is everything okay?" "Sure," John said. He knew his two rooms were without character or comfort, but he didn't want to offer his father the means to maneuver. "Is it warm enough out here?" "Pretty much. I don't have any hot water to speak of. I get 5 minutes worth of lukewarm dribble before it runs out." "Well, that's no good. I'm glad you brought it up. I'll have Mona take care of it." John suspected he'd just given his father an opening to the Mona discussion that loomed. It was up to his father to proceed without any help from him. "Mind if I sit down?" John moved a pile of dirty clothes from a wooden desk chair so his father could take a seat. Lionel began a long, rambling discourse about the new blended family. He acknowledged that things were sometimes tense between Mona and John, but she was doing her best, and Lionel said it was only fair that John meet her halfway. John stared at him, bemused by the enormity of Lionel's self-delusion. Of course, his father was her defender. She and Lionel were allies. John had no recourse. There was no court of appeals. In effect, his father was announcing that John was totally at her mercy. Her whims, her sharp tongue, her uncanny ability to seize the upper hand. For all of this, she had Lionel's blessing. John couldn't believe his father didn't see what was going on. "Well, Dad," he said carefully, "not to be obtuse about it, but from my perspective, she's a clusterfuck." Lionel reacted as though slapped. "Well, son, you're certainly entitled to your opinion, but I trust you'll keep it to yourself. I'd appreciate it if you'd try to get along with her, for my sake, if nothing else." "For your sake? How do you figure that?" Lionel shook his head, his tone patient. "I know the adjustment isn't easy. She'll never replace your mother. She's not asking for that, and neither am I. You have to trust me on this. She's a caring person. Amazing, really, once you get to know her better. In the meantime, I expect you to treat her with the respect she deserves." It was the word amazing that somehow stuck in John's craw. Mona was the enemy, but he could see how futile it was to battle her head on. After that, John referred to her as the amazing Mona, though never in his father's company and never to her face. The newlyweds' first Christmas together, the amazing Mona had inveigled Lionel to play Santa for a Climping Academy fundraiser, and every year thereafter, he donned his white wig, white beard, and white mustache, and then climbed into a red velvet fat suit trimmed in white fur. Even his boots were fake. In John's mind, the photograph that exactly captured their relationship was the one in a silver frame Mona displayed on the baby grand piano in the newly decorated living room. In it, she was decked out in a low-cut Yves Saint Laurent evening gown, perched seductively on Santa's lap. While she glowed for the camera, Lionel's identity was obliterated. She did manage to raise over $100,000 for the school, and for this she was widely praised. John unburdened himself bitterly to his brother by phone. "She's such a total bitch. She's a tyrant, I'm telling you. She's a fucking narcissist," Grant said. "Oh, come on. You'll be out of the house in a year or two, so what's it to you?" "She thinks she can run my life, and Dad lets her get away with it. Talk about being pussy-whipped." "So what? That's his business, not yours." "Shit, that's easy for you to say. I'd like to see you try living under the same roof with her." Bored with the topic, Grant said, "Just tough it out. Once you finish high school, you can come live with me. I'm not moving away from all my friends. That's the best I can offer. Stiff upper lip, old chum." John discovered a new way to occupy his time. He began breaking into various Horton Ravine homes he knew were unoccupied. While he caddied at the club, he picked up all manner of information about members' travel plans. Guys chatted among themselves about upcoming cruises and European tours. Jaunts to San Francisco, Chicago, and New York. It was a form of bragging, though it was couched in queries about exchange rates, good deals on charter flights, and luxury hotels. Lionel and Mona socialized with most of them, so all John had to do was look up their addresses in Mona's Rolodex. He'd wait until the family was gone and find his way in. If there was talk of an alarm system or a house sitter, he knew to avoid the place. People were careless about locking up. John found windows unlatched, basement doors unsecured. Failing that, he scouted out the house keys hidden under flower pots and fake garden rocks. Once inside, he cruised the premises, poking through closets and dresser drawers. Home offices were a rich source of information. He was curious about women's underwear, about the fragrances they used, their personal hygiene. He didn't steal anything. That wasn't the point. Breaking and entering gave him temporary relief from anxiety. The heightened fear level washed away the stress he carried, and his equilibrium was restored. He started cutting classes at Climp, first occasionally, then more often. Not surprisingly, his grades tumbled. He He was secretly amused at all the murmuring that went on behind his back. There were conferences at school and conferences at home. Notes went back and forth. Phone calls were exchanged. Lionel didn't want to be the bad guy, so Mona was the one who finally lowered the boom. She was stern and reproving, and John made every effort to keep a straight face while she read him the riot act. Your father and I have discussed this at length. You have great potential, John, but you're not putting forth your best effort. Since you're doing so poorly, we think it's a waste of our money to pay private school tuition. If you're unwilling to apply yourself at Klimp, we think you should transfer to Santa Teresa High. John knew what she was up to. She thought the threat of public school would give her leverage. He shrugged. That's cool. Santa Teresa High School. Let's do it. Mona frowned, unable to believe he wasn't going to protest her ruling and promise to improve. I'm sure you'll want to graduate with your classmates at Klimp, so we'd be willing to discuss it after the first semester at Santa Teresa High, assuming you do better. If you show us you can bring your grades up, we'll see that you're transferred back. The decision is yours. I already decided. I'll take the public high school. The fall of 1966, at the end of John's first day at Santa Teresa High, he was standing at his locker when a kid at the locker next to his looked over and smiled. You're new. I saw you this morning. We're in the same homeroom. Right. I remember. I'm John Corso. The kid extended his hand. Walker McNally. The two shook hands, and then Walker said, Where are you from? I was at Klimp last year. I flunked out. Walker laughed. Good job. I like it. Welcome to Santa Teresa High. He opened his locker and dumped his books, then took out a windbreaker and shrugged himself into it. Speaking of high, this seems like an occasion worth celebrating. You have a car? In the parking lot. Walker reached into his jacket pocket and removed a joint. Shall we adjourn, good sir? The first time John smoked dope was the first time he'd laughed in years. The laughter was hard-edged and uncontrollable. Later, he couldn't even remember what he found so funny. But in the moment, it had felt like happiness, however empty and artificially induced. Chapter 16. Wednesday, April 13th, 1988. Wednesday morning, I came up against a stumbling block. As usual, I rolled out of bed, pulled on my sweats and running shoes, brushed my teeth, and headed out the door. I used the walk from my studio to Cabana Boulevard to warm up, setting a brisk pace to prime my pumping heart and soften the long muscles that kept my legs moving. By the time I reached the wharf at the foot of State Street, I'd break into a trot, picking up the tempo as I proceeded. Sometimes I jogged on the bike path and sometimes on the sidewalk, depending on the number of runners, walkers, and bicyclists out on any given morning. Ahead of me, a group of seniors had taken up a big chunk of the bike path, walking 4 people across and 8 to 10 people deep in 2 separate clusters. I opted for the sidewalk to avoid the stragglers. On my left, I passed a row of coin-operated newspaper stands, and I gave them a cursory glance. The name popped out at me, and I paused to read the headlines, most of which were dated the day before. The latest edition of the LA Times, the Perdido County Record, and the San Francisco Chronicle would replace the old issues as soon as the delivery truck made its morning rounds. What caught my attention was an article in the Santa Teresa Dispatch. On the left-hand side of the front page, just above the fold, the heading read, UCST co-ed killed in drunk driver mishap. In the next line down, I saw Walker McNally's name. I tried to peer past the frame, but the balance of the story was blocked from my view. I don't carry money when I run, so I was forced to circumvent the tiny issue of the lock. I gave the window flap a quick couple of jerks, and up it popped. I removed a copy of the dispatch, and let the window snap back into the locked position. I turned to the first section and read the article while I walked. When I reached the bus stop, I sank onto a bench and read the whole of it again. On Monday afternoon, a UCST sophomore named Julie Reardon had been killed in a two-car collision on Highway 154 while returning home from San Francisco. Walker McNally had been at the wheel of the other car. According to witnesses, he lost control of his Mercedes, crossed into oncoming traffic, and slammed into her head-on. He'd then crawled out of the wreckage and had taken off on foot. By the time the cops caught up with him, he'd collapsed on the side of the road. He'd been admitted to St. Terry's with a blood alcohol level well over the legal limit. His injuries were non-life-threatening, and his condition was listed as stable. Julie Reardon, age 19, was pronounced dead at the scene. No wonder Carolyn McNally had hung up on me. Walker was probably still in the hospital when I'd called his house. She must have assumed I'd been hired to investigate the accident. When and if Walker returned to work, assuming he hadn't been thrown in the pokey in the interim, he wasn't going to be any friendlier than his wife had been. His colleagues at the bank would be on lockdown as well, warned about disseminating information of even the most benign sort. All I wanted was his father's current address and a few minutes of his time. If Dr. McNally had forgotten the dog, I'd be facing another dead end. But it made me crazy to think he might be in town and me with no access. I flirted with the idea of contacting Diana Alvarez. She could probably bully or bullshit her way through to any source she pleased, but I didn't want to tip her to my interest in the wolf dog buried on that hill. Flanagan Sanchez had given me as much information as he had, so another chat with him would net me nothing. I abandoned the run and went home. I tossed the newspaper on the counter and flipped on the TV. I tuned into one of the local stations, hoping the story would be covered in an upcoming news segment. All I caught was an endless stream of commercials. I tried two more channels with the same result. I left the TV on and went upstairs to shower. Once I was dressed, I put the coffee on and then ate a piece of toast while I read the article again. No two ways about it. Walker McNally was in deep shit. So, now what? On my way into the office, I stopped off at the market. I needed to replace the bug-infested foodstuffs I'd discarded on Monday. I wasn't likely to cook or bake, but my barren shelves looked pitiful. I stocked up on flour, cornmeal, cereal, and crackers, both Graham and saltines, if you really want to know. I also bought baking soda and a container of baking powder. I'd noticed as I tossed the old one in the trash that the best if used by date on the bottom of the tin was March 1985. On a roll by then, I bought dried bow tie pasta and long grain rice, along with cans of tomato sauce, tomato paste, and diced tomatoes with onion and basil. I was shopping only to give my beleaguered brain a rest. I needed a new game plan, and I wouldn't come up with one if I tried to tackle the problem directly. I moved to the next aisle, piling tissue boxes, rolls of paper towels, and toilet paper in my cart. I had my hand on a container of liquid detergent when a possible solution occurred to me. I finished my shopping, paid for my groceries, and stowed everything in the trunk of my car. Then I slid under the wheel and took my notebook out of my shoulder bag, leafing through the pages until I found the address Sanchez had given me for the McNally Pet Hospital on Dave Levine Street. At the back of my mind, I'd been playing a little game of suppose and what if in my quest to find Walker's dad. I'd thought, what if, on his retirement, Dr. McNally had sold his practice to another veterinarian. The new vet might well know his current whereabouts. I fired up my Mustang and pulled out of the lot. I hung a right on Chapel and drove the length of it until I reached the dead end at Miracle, where I turned left for a half a block. This put me at Dave Levine Street, 6 blocks from the point at which it split from State. The address I wanted had to be somewhere to my left. I turned and continued at a greatly reduced speed until I reached Solitario Street. On the far side of the intersection, in a 7-tenant strip mall, I spotted Mid-City Cat Clinic, with an address that matched the one Sanchez had given me. I snagged the only parking space available and sat for a moment, hoping the gods would be merciful. A wooden cutout of a puss in boots pointed at the clinic door, where the names of two veterinarians were stenciled on the pane. Stephanie Forbes, DVM, and Vespa Chin, DVM. I got out, locked the car, and went in. The waiting room was small and neat, with a counter on the right that separated the receptionist's desk from the clientele. Behind her was a bank of charts, sporting a rainbow of tabs. A wall-mounted chart illustrated the difference between a fit cat and a fat cat. A nearby bulletin board was plastered with snapshots of cats that I imagine had been treated by the venerable doctors Forbes and Chin. Through a doorway, I saw wire cages that held an assortment of felines, some perhaps boarders and some being treated for various kitty ills. The receptionist at the desk looked up at me as I came in. She was in her 60s. Her salt-and-pepper hair was heavy on the salt, shoulder-length and blunt-cut. Her bifocals had beveled edges with thin wire stems. The tops of the lenses were tinted blue and the bottoms tinted pink. I wondered how the world looked from her perspective. "Can I help you?" she asked. "I'm hoping you can give me some information." "I'll try," she said. Her smock was patterned with cats, every conceivable color combination, with real cat hair matted here and there. She looked like someone who'd carry a cat around while the office was closed for lunch. Belatedly, I noticed a small gray cat lying on her desk, curled in sleep like a hairy paperweight. "I'm looking for the vet who used to own this facility."
"Dr. McNally?"
"Exactly. Did you work for him by chance?"
"No, but he cared for all my animals over the years. 2 dogs, and I can't even tell you how many cats."
"Do you have any idea how I can reach him?" She hesitated.
"Why do you ask?"
"Well, I've got an odd little problem, and this is what it is." I recited my strange request without a hitch. I glossed over the surrounding circumstances, not wanting to raise a red flag with regard to Mary Claire Fitzhugh. I did explain Ulf, the buried dog, the tag, the former owner who knew nothing of the dog's interment in Horton Ravine. "I'm hoping Dr. McNally can fill in the blanks."
"It's very possible. I'm sure he'd enjoy a visit. He's at Valley Oaks, number 17, Juniper Lane. Hang on a second and I'll look up his phone number."
She opened the bottommost drawer on her right and took out a leather-bound address book that looked like it was meant for personal use.
"Do you want me to call and let him know you'll be stopping by?"
"I'm not sure what my schedule is for the rest of the week, so it's probably better not to call in advance. I don't want him sitting around thinking he'll have company if I can't get there for a day or two."
"Understood," she said. She made a note of his phone number and address and passed it across the desk.
"Thank you so much. I really appreciate this." I tucked the note in my bag. Hesitantly, she said, "I don't suppose you're in the market for a cat. We have so many strays dropped at our door. Some are older and harder to place, but you have no idea how loving they are."
"I'll keep that in mind."
The Valley Oaks Senior Settlement had been established at an old estate in Montebello. I like the word settlement. It suggested an encampment on the far reaches of life, where aging pioneers could find shelter and companionship. At the entrance, a painted map board showed a layout of the units, and I took a minute to locate number 17 Juniper Lane. I drove through the gate at a crawl, obeying the sign that warned about speed bumps that appeared every 15 feet. The landscaping was beautifully maintained. Many of the old oaks had been left in place, splitting off from the main thoroughfare. A series of winding roads disappeared in all directions, each marked with a discreet sign
indicating the name of the road and the unit numbers thereon. A few of the units I spotted had ramps to accommodate wheelchair users. Through the trees, I could see an imposing structure, which I imagined was the original mansion converted now to public rooms where residents could visit, dine, or entertain. Number 17 Juniper Lane was a cottage Hansel and Gretel would have liked, a snug stucco structure with a roof that looked like thatch. The front door was dark green, the shutters painted to match. A cluster of flower pots took up one corner of the porch, all of them empty at the moment. On the drive over, as I rehearsed my approach, I decided not to mention my sketchy acquaintance with his son. I assumed Dr. McNally was aware of Walker's legal problems, and it wasn't a topic that would be productive. Walker's accident had nothing to do with my quest. I parked in a four-car inset between cottages. I knocked, and after a moment the door was opened by a man in his 80s. His hair was thick, gray, cropped short, and his bifocals had metal frames. I didn't see any particular likeness to Walker, but then again, I hadn't seen Walker in years, so the two might appear more similar than I knew. He had on a navy blue sweatshirt with sleeves pushed up and shorts that were creased across the lap. He wore slippers instead of shoes and socks, and his shins looked like soup bones sparsely dotted with hair. Dr. McNally?
Yes?
I'm sorry for the intrusion, but I'm hoping to pick up information about a dog you euthanized some years ago. He looked at me, waiting to see if I'd say more.
With what in mind? I don't understand your purpose.
The dog was found buried on a property in Horton Ravine. This came to light last week, and it's been puzzling me. I used the dog's tag to track down its owner in Puerto, and he was as puzzled as I was. I realize it's a long shot, but I'm hoping you can tell me how he ended up in Horton Ravine.
I see.
He thought about it briefly and then seemed to make up his mind.
Why don't you come in?
I've got a good head for animals, but I don't remember much else.
How many years ago was this?
21.
Oh, my.
He stepped back and I crossed the threshold into a foyer tiled in slate. He closed the door behind me and then led the way down a short hall toward the rear. I caught glimpses of a bedroom to my right and a book-lined study to my left. At the back of the cottage, there was a great room with a seating area on one side and a kitchenette on the other. A small dining room table and two chairs were arranged against an oversized mullioned window that looked out on a patch of lawn. Everything was tidy. There was no sign of Mrs. McNally. I don't know how women can complain about the lack of single guys in this world. He sat in a plump upholstered chair, and I took one end of the matching sofa. He put his hands on his knees and said,
"Tell me more about what you need. I'm not entirely clear how to help."
"This is the deal," I said. "In the summer of 1967, a fellow brought his dog into your office. This was a wolf dog named Ulf. I'm told you sedated him and took x-rays that showed an osteosarcoma. You recommended putting the dog down." Walter was nodding.
"I remember. Young dog, maybe 4 or 5 years old."
"Really? You remember him?"
"I couldn't have told you his name, but I know the animal you're referring to. He was the only wolf dog I ever had occasion to treat. You see more of the mix these days, but back then it was rare. As I recall, the fellow called a number of pet hospitals in the area, and none of the other vets would agree to see him. Beautiful beast. Absolutely magnificent. He had so much wolf in him, he looked like he'd just come loping out of the woods. He'd apparently been experiencing episodes of lameness that seemed to be getting worse. I thought about osteosarcoma the minute his owner mentioned the joint being so extremely tender. An x-ray confirmed my suspicions. A tumor of that sort doesn't cross the joint space and invade other bones. It's a gradual expansion in the joint where it's found, destroying the bone from the inside out and causing excruciating pain. On the views I took, it looked like the bone had been eaten away. The dog couldn't be saved. That's the long and short of it. I knew the fellow was upset, but I gave him my best advice, and that was to spare the animal further suffering. The man's name was P.F. Sanchez. The dog belonged to his deceased son. I see.
Well,
that's a sad situation that could pile misery upon misery. It's hard enough having to put an animal down, regardless of the circumstances. But when the dog belongs to a child you've lost... He let the sentence trail off. What would have happened to the dog after he was put down? County Animal Control picked up the remains and disposed of them. We'd placed the body in a canvas bag that we left in a storage shed out back. This was a wooden contraption that could be opened from either side. I don't know how things are handled these days. I believe with recent budget cuts, the county has discontinued the pickup service, and it's up to the individual veterinarian to deliver the remains to the animal control facility. Whatever the procedure, the animals are incinerated. That much is the same. I would have assumed that was Ulf's fate until you told me otherwise. Did the county make daily sweeps? He shook his head. We called when we had a pickup, and they'd be there by the end of the business day. Did you ever have reason to bury the remains yourself? No. I understand the desire to bury a pet in the backyard, but I wouldn't have taken it upon myself. The animal wasn't mine. Would you know if the county kept a record of pickups? There wouldn't have been any reason to. We had a form the pet owner signed, giving permission for an animal to be euthanized. Sometimes the owner would ask us to return the ashes, and sometimes animal control was asked to dispose of them. I can't imagine why that would be subject to dispute. No, there's no dispute, I said. Sanchez told me he gave you authorization by phone. I don't remember his doing so, but that sounds right. What about your records? Those are gone. When I retired, some charts were forwarded to other vets on request, and the rest I put in storage. I held everything 10 years and then boxed up the lot and called a shredding company. It probably wasn't necessary, but I didn't like the idea of personal information going into the trash. Can you think of any reason why Ulf wouldn't have been picked up and cremated? Some special circumstance? McNally shook his head again. That was protocol. Most people keep the ashes. Some do and some don't. What makes you ask? I was just curious. I don't own a pet, so I have no idea how these things are done. People get attached. Sometimes a dog or cat means more to you than your own flesh and blood. I understand, I said. Well, I've taken up enough of your time. I reached for my shoulder bag and found a business card before I got to my feet. I'll leave you this in case something else occurs to you. He rose at the same time, still talking as he walked me to the door. I'm sorry I couldn't be more help. You gave me more than I expected. It's frustrating, but I guess I'll have to live with it. What hangs in the balance? That's what you ought to ask yourself. I don't know yet. Maybe nothing. Don't let it keep you awake nights. It's bad for your health. What about you? Do you sleep well? He smiled. I do. I've been blessed. I had a wonderful family and work that I loved. I'm in excellent health, and I have all my faculties about me, as far as I know, he added wryly. I managed to set aside enough money to enjoy my dotage, so it's a matter now of staying active. Some people aren't as fortunate. You're a lucky man. That I am. Getting in my car again, I wondered how lucky he'd feel when he heard about the trouble his son Walker was in. If he'd been informed, he gave no indication of it. On my way back to the office, I made a second trip to the Mid-City Cat Clinic, this time turning into the alleyway behind the place. The name of each business was stenciled on the back door, so it was easy to spot the shed Dr. McNally'd mentioned. I parked and got out, inspecting it at close range. It was smaller than the housing used for garbage cans mounted on the wall to the right of the door. The wood construction was straightforward, with a simple metal hook that fit into a small metal eye. There was no other locking mechanism visible, and no evidence there'd ever been one. There wasn't even a hasp where a padlock or a combination lock could have been inserted and secured. I pulled the wooden knob, and the door opened with scarcely a sound. Except for dried leaves and spider webs, the interior was empty and didn't appear to be in use. At the back of the shed, the door that had opened into the clinic in Dr. McNally's day had been boarded up. I studied the alley in both directions. Across the way, I could see a series of private garages with gated walkways leading into backyards, most of which were separated by fencing. This was a public thoroughfare, utilitarian in nature, but accessible from either end. Anybody could have known about the pickups, pet hospital staff and clientele, animal control officers, neighbors, adjacent businesses, trash collectors, vagrants. Cleverly, I'd narrowed the field of corpse-napping suspects to a couple of hundred unknown individuals. The question still remained, why would someone steal a dead dog and transport it to Horton Ravine for burial? Unless, as Sutton had suggested, the two men felt compelled to substitute Ulf's remains for whatever or whomever they were in the process of burying when the 6-year-old Sutton stumbled onto the scene. I'd dismissed the notion when he'd mentioned it, but now I reconsidered. An adult male wolf dog would have been far bigger than a 4-year-old child. But since I didn't have a way to determine what had actually happened, maybe it was time to approach the question from another point of view. Not the motive for the dog's removal and subsequent burial, but the choice of the spot. Why there and not somewhere else? Chapter 17. After lunch, I drove to Horton Ravine, taking Via Giuliana as far as the Y, where Alita Lane branched off. I parked in front of Felix Holderman's house, locked the car, and ambled up his driveway. To my right, at the far end of the house, the overhead doors were open on his 3-car garage. A late-model sedan sat in the first bay, and the other two had been converted into a workshop. Felix had his back to me, but he sensed my presence. He looked up and lifted a hand to signal that he'd be with me momentarily, and then returned to the task in front of him. He wore dark blue denim overalls, a long-sleeve shirt, gloves, and goggles. In an open cabinet to one side, sheets of colored glass were stored vertically. As I approached, I could see that he was creating a stained glass panel. On the workbench, he'd laid out a design, a stylized pattern of trees, leaves, and branches against a white background. He'd cut paper templates for each section of the design, and these he'd glue to various pieces of glass. As I watched, he ran a wheel glass cutter along the edge of one template. He'd already cut a number of sections, and I waited while he completed the straight line he was tracing. When he finished, he tapped the glass, and it broke neatly. He lifted his goggles and pushed them up on his head. I said, "Hi, Mr. Holderman. Sorry to interrupt your work." He peeled off his gloves and laid them on the work surface with a shake of his head. "Don't worry about it. I was ready for a break. I get lost in this stuff, and it's good to come up for air now and then. You were the one who knocked on my door and asked to walk the hill. You should have told me what you were up to." "Sorry for the omission, but I didn't think I'd succeed. I should have laid it out for you regardless." "I've blanked on your name." "Kinsey Milhone," I said. "Did the officers bring you up to speed?" "After the fact. They seemed to think you were onto something." "I did too, but I've been wrong before, and such is life." I peered at the section of stained glass he was working on. "You made the panels in your front door?" "I did. This one's a bit more complex, but I'm having a good time." "That's the lead." He nodded. It's called came. These are U-shaped cross-sections for the circumference and H-shaped for the middle of the design. Lead came is meant for two-dimensional panes. You want to do three dimensions, you use a copper foil technique. What will you do with the window when it's done? Give it away. Just about everybody in my family's had a window foisted off on them at some point. My daughter's house looks like a church. He smiled, showing dimples I hadn't seen before. What brings you back to the neighborhood? I'm curious about the people who owned the property where the dog was buried. You mentioned the house changed hands twice. Did you know the previous owners?
Oh, sure.
Patrick and Deborah Unruh. Nice folks. The dog wasn't theirs, if that's what you're wondering. I know. I've talked to the real owner, and he has no idea how the dog ended up in someone else's backyard. There's probably a simple explanation. That whole section of the hill was overgrown back then. Maybe whoever buried the dog didn't realize it was private property. Could be, I said. When did the Unruhs sell the house? You got me there. It's been at least 15 years. I'd say closer to 20. Did they buy another house in the area? No. They moved to a gated community in Los Angeles. He owned a manufacturing plant making uniforms, sports gear, and outerwear. He worked down there through the week and drove up here weekends. You think he wanted a place closer to his business? That'd be my guess. The move was abrupt, which I thought was odd. They were here one day, gone the next. I remember chatting with them at a barbecue a few days before, and neither said a word about plans to relocate. Next thing I know, there's a moving van in the drive, and guys are loading up the household goods. Do you remember when this was? Not a clue. One of the neighbors might know. The gal next door, Avis Gent, kept in touch for a while. She could tell you more. What about you? No exchange of Christmas cards? We weren't close friends. More like social acquaintances. Patrick was killed in a plane crash a couple of years ago. After that, I heard Deborah moved back here, but I've never had it confirmed. A town this size, you'd think you'd run into people all the time, but you don't. Do you think she remarried? I ask because I'm wondering if she's still using the name Unruh. Probably. From what I saw of them, they were one of those magic twosomes who mate for life. They even looked alike, both tall and trim and fair-haired. Any children? Just one. A boy named Greg. She and Patrick ended up raising his daughter, Rain. So that might count as two kids. What's the story on him? Typical of the times. Early 60s, he went off to college as a clean-cut kid and came home looking like a bum. I believe it was the summer after his sophomore year, he and this little gal showed up in a yellow school bus. He'd been traveling across the country thinking what a free spirit he was while he borrowed money from his folks. Turned out his girlfriend was pregnant, and the two of them were broke. Deborah and Patrick offered them a place to stay. Nothing permanent, just until the baby came. The girl already had one kid, 5 or 6 years old. Greg parked the bus on one side of the cabana, and that's where they hung out. I used to see the little boy running around the front yard without a stitch of clothes on. Deborah and Patrick were fit to be tied. To top it off, once the baby was born, Greg and What's-Her-Face took off with the boy and left the little girl behind. After 2 years of no contact and no financial support, the court terminated their parental rights and the Unruhs adopted her. Sounds like a soap opera. It was. They thought they'd seen the last of them, but here they came again some time later, in the same school bus, only now it was covered with peace signs and psychedelic paint. It was the talk of the neighborhood. Greg had changed his name to Creed, and she was Destiny. I forget what her name was before. Her son was 10 or 11 by then. They called him Sky Dancer. Sky, for short. Oh, dear, I said. And the daughter was Rain? Patricia Lorraine. The shortened version came before it occurred to them to rename themselves.
Why'd they come back?
Beats me. They left again abruptly some weeks later. By then, Deborah was worried the day would come when the bio mom would try getting her daughter back, so that might have been another reason she and Patrick packed up and left. Gone. No forwarding, as far as those hippies were concerned.
Could the bio mom have done that? Reclaimed the child?
Hard to say. The courts can be capricious when it comes to the welfare of a child. Judges sometimes put too much stock in nature and not enough in nurture. Deborah and Patrick were terrific parents, but why take the risk?
Who left first, Greg or his parents?
He did, definitely. It was the second time he'd decamped with his common-law wife. Deborah had no intention of putting up with that again.
What happened to him?
Last I heard, he and Destiny were heavy into free love and dope. Flower children, that's what they called themselves, remember that? Sticking daisies down the rifle barrels of the National Guardsmen, like that would make a difference. I laughed. That's right. 1967 was the summer of love. What were they thinking? He smiled and shook his head. That's how you know you're getting old, when you start looking back with kindness on things you knew for sure were ridiculous at the time.
At least they believed in something. Kids I see these days don't seem to have passions of any kind.
That's the other way you know you're getting old. When you say crap like that, he said with a laugh. Anyway, I didn't mean to get sidetracked. Do you think the dog's burial is significant?
I don't know, but I'll tell you what's bugging me.
That dog's body was stolen from the veterinarian who put him to sleep.
Does that make sense to you?
Not much. He nodded at the house next door. Before you give up, you might want to talk to Avis.
I didn't say I was giving up. I think the pieces are there. I just don't understand how they fit.
I left his house, walking past my car, on my way to her place next door. In truth, I was talked out for the day, and I would have preferred to head home. I had a lot to absorb, and I wanted to make notes while the information was fresh. At the same time, the woman lived no more than 50 yards away, and I figured I might as well make contact while I was close. I hadn't known her name before Felix mentioned it, but I'd put her on my mental list, along with the neighbors in the houses across the street. It had been a while since I'd done an old-fashioned canvas, trotting from door to door, introducing myself. As a PI apprentice under the tutelage of Ben Bird and Morley Shine, this was how it was done. You followed a trail of crumbs through the forest and pecked them up one by one. Thus far, I was still lost, but my appetite hadn't been satisfied, so I went on. Mrs. Gent's one-story house was plain, a typical 1950s construction that would probably hop off its foundation at the next big earthquake. I hoped her insurance premiums were up to date. While the neighborhood was affluent, there was the occasional house, like hers, tucked among more prestigious properties. Once disaster struck, someone would come along and offer her top dollar just to get their hands on the lot. In the meantime, there wasn't much to be said for the exterior. Rough stucco, painted a melon color, with a low-pitched roof covered with rocks the size of popcorn embedded in tar. By way of contrast, the lawn was a lush green, and the landscaping was well-designed, which lent the house more grace than would otherwise have been in evidence. When I rang the front bell, I found myself staring at one of Felix's stained glass panes in the door. The design must have been one of his early ones, a simply rendered cluster of grapes beside a wine glass shaped like a U on a stick and half-filled with red wine. This was a portent, since the woman who answered the door carried a wine glass much like it, only cloudy with fingerprints. In her other hand, she held a cigarette. Her eyes were brown, and her hair was a dark, carroty red, cut into short, wispy strands that curled up around her head like flames. I placed her in her 50s, though she might have been younger and suffering the aging effects of booze and smokes. She was barefoot and wore a vibrant green silk kimono.
Mrs. Gent?
I am. Felix suggested I talk to you. Her movements were liquid, and she swayed in my direction.
Sure. I can do that. You have a name?
Kinsey Milhone.
You caught me at the cocktail hour. Would you care to join me?
Without waiting for a reply, she turned and the kimono blossomed out around her like a matador's cape. Fortunately, she had her back to me by then, so I wasn't subjected to anything unseemly. Was she wearing underpants? She padded down the hallway, talking over her shoulder, while I followed in the wake of smoke and alcohol fumes. Surreptitiously, I checked my watch. It was 2:30.
Don't be a fuss budget, she said, apparently catching my move out of the corner of her eye.
Sorry. Wine would be great.
White or red?
White. Chardonnay or Sauvignon Blanc?
Chardonnay.
She held a finger up.
Bingo! That's correct.
The interior of the house was surprisingly modern. The living room walls were painted cobalt blue, and the hall was done in rust. The floors were polished hard wood, and the furniture design was stark and uninviting. The paintings were oversized and abstract, bright splashes of red, white, and yellow.
I'm Avis, by the way. That Mrs. Gent malarkey is for the birds. Archie Gent was my third. I was married to him the longest, but I'm not anymore. He was an engineer, if you know the type. He walked around looking like he was trying to shit a bowling ball. I went on the wagon for a while and realized I liked him better when I was drunk. I decided to keep his last name as long as he's paying the rent.
Are you married?
Not now.
How many times?
Twice.
Oh, good. We can compare notes. I had a couple stinkers. How about you?
I wish I could say they were at fault, but I carried half the blame.
Oh, please. Don't pretend you're fair-minded. It's unbecoming.
We arrived in the kitchen, which was stark white, anchored by dark green marble surfaces. The appliances were stainless steel. Copper pots hung from a rack. She opened the door to an under-counter glass-fronted wine cooler, pulling out first the top rack and then the next one down. She removed a bottle and read the label, saying, Talbot, Diamond Tea. She held it out so I could see the label as well.
You know the wine?
I don't. I peered at the year, which was 1985, and I wondered if that was a good one.
Well, you're in for a treat.
I go through a case of Diamond Tea every other week, in between assorted other cocktails.
Shit!
She knocked the live ember from her cigarette, and it settled on the floor near her bare foot like a small red bug.
Would you get that for me? Paper towels are under the sink.
I stepped on the ember and then found the roll of paper toweling. I tore off a sheet, wet it, and made quick work of the ash, which I tossed in the wastebasket. While she struggled to uncork the wine, I said, Mind if I look around?
Have at it.
I circled the kitchen, glancing into the three adjoining rooms, a glassed-in back porch that ran the width of the house, formal dining room, and den. By the time I finished my mini-tour, she'd taken out an enormous wine glass and poured me enough Chardonnay to float a small school of fish.
We can sit on the porch unless you have a better idea.
I'm with you, I said. I tagged after her as she crossed the kitchen in a billow of silk. Windows, mounted above wainscoting, now enclosed what had probably once been a bare concrete patio. A sisal carpet covered much of the floor, and the windows could be protected with roll-up blinds if the sun hit at a blinding angle at odd times of the day. The furniture was white wicker, old-fashioned compared to the rest of the house. Looking out, I realized the house to the right of hers was where the Unruhs had lived. I couldn't see the spot where the Tex had gone to work, but it felt odd to know I was in range of a site that had occupied so much of my imagination of late.
She settled on one of two love seats that faced each other across a wicker coffee table. She leaned forward and snagged an ashtray, pulling it closer so she could light another cigarette. The ashtray was metal, and the spent paper match made a tinking sound when she tossed it in. She took a deep drag on her cigarette and blew out a stream of smoke, lifting her head slightly to avoid blowing it in my face. "Now then, why did Felix send you over here? Natural charm aside, I'm sure you have a deeper purpose in mind. I'm interested in talking to Deborah Unruh. Felix thought you might put me in touch."
"Really?
And what's your interest?"
"I'm a PI."
"Excuse me?"
"I'm a private investigator. My client was the one who motivated the cops to dig up the Unruh's backyard."
"How did your client talk them into it? That must have been a trick."
"He remembered something that happened when he was 6 years old and thought it was connected to a crime."
"And what crime was that?"
"I'd prefer not to say."
"I see.
So you want information from me, but you won't pony up yourself."
"Good point. I'm talking about the Mary Claire Fitzhugh kidnapping."
"What's that have to do with Deborah?"
"They dug up a damn dog. I don't see the relevance."
"The dog was buried in 1967 when she and Patrick were still living in the house."
"I'd say, so what, but I don't want to sound rude."
"It was right around the time Mary Claire Fitzhugh disappeared."
She studied me briefly.
"You're not drinking your wine."
"It's a little early in the day for me."
"I usually start at noon, so this is late as far as I'm concerned."
"You really ought to loosen up. One little taste won't kill you."
I took a sip of wine, which I confess was head and shoulders above the crap I'm used to drinking.
"Wow, that's really lovely."
"Told you so."
She was silent for a moment, pressing a wrinkle out of the silk in her lap.
"Funny you should mention Mary Claire."
"How so?"
She studied the end of her cigarette.
"Don't think I'm telling tales out of school here, but Deborah had a similar experience. Her granddaughter, Rain, was abducted maybe 10 days before Mary Claire was kidnapped. Happily, Rain was returned unharmed. But Deborah believed Rain was what she called the practice child. Rehearsal in preparation for the real deal.
Chapter 18. John Corso. Summer 1967. The amazing Mona had arranged an 8-week trip to France and Italy, departing after the school year ended in June. She and the girls had been to Europe when she was married to her former husband, and now she wanted to relive the joys of foreign travel with Lionel in tow. Lionel saw the trip as an opportunity to do research for a book on the lesser-known American expatriates writing in Paris after World War I. By May of John's senior year at Santa Teresa High, his academic performance was so poor that it was clear he wasn't going to graduate. As a consequence, he was excluded from the family vacation. He was 3 credits short of what was required for his diploma, and he'd managed to exasperate just about everyone, including his English teacher, Mr. Snow, who snagged him one afternoon after class. Mr. Snow was 35 years old, dedicated and energetic, new to Santa Teresa High School, where he taught English and creative writing. He'd had 2 novels published, and he was working on his third. He perched on the edge of his desk with his gradebook open in front of him. He ran his finger down the column of John's classroom grades, many of which read incomplete. He shook his head while John sat in the front row, posing as a kid busy contemplating his sins. Mr. Snow said, "I don't know what to do with you, John. This class is an elective. This is all you needed to graduate, and you blew it. You're a bright kid, and you write well when and if you get around to do it. You might even have some talent lurking in that thick skull of yours. If you'd done even half the assignments, you'd have passed with no problem.
Why are you doing this?
John shrugged. The topics are boring. I can't relate.
You can't relate? Are you kidding me?
What do you want me to say?
Where's this horseshit coming from? That's what I don't get.
You did well at Klimp until your junior year. I know because I called the school and checked. Now your GPA is in the toilet. I don't think you lost any IQ points, so what gives?
John shrugged. He kept his eyes pinned on Mr. Snow's, but his expression was blank.
Mr. Snow stared at him. Are you having problems at home?
Not really.
You want to talk about it?
There's nothing to talk about.
Mr. Snow closed his eyes for a beat and tried another tack.
You have plans for college?
City College, maybe. I haven't decided yet.
Well, you better pull your thumb out. If you don't get into some college, you risk being called up.
I thought they were mostly taking older guys.
You want to take that chance?
The last 2 years, they've bumped up the draft to 35,000 a month. That's a lot of young men.
Yes, sir. I'm aware of that, he said, polite but unyielding.
Mr. Snow set the gradebook aside.
Do you like to write?
I'm asking because when you bother to do it, you're not half bad.
Writing's okay.
I like it pretty well. I mean, not all the time, but sometimes.
Mr. Snow studied him.
Here's what I'm willing to do. I'll set you up in an independent studies program, just the two of us. You turn in the work, and you'll pass. I guarantee it. Mr. Albertson might even let you go through the graduation ceremony. He can leave your diploma blank, and we'll take care of it at the end of summer school, assuming you haven't dropped the ball.
What would I have to do?
Well, John, this is a writing class. You'd have to write, as wacky as that might seem. If you're bored with my topics, you can tackle your own.
Like what?
That's up to you. You can't have it both ways. You either do the pieces I assign, or you come up with your own. At the end of each week, you turn in everything you've done, and I mean everything. False starts, cross-outs, bad paragraphs, ideas that bomb. The first time you fail to deliver, you're out.
Do we have a deal?
I'll think about it, John said. I'm making a sales pitch. The offer's on the table for 10 minutes.
Mr. Snow glanced pointedly at his watch.
Okay, fine. We have a deal. John was thinking it would be a breeze. He liked Mr. Snow. The guy was blunt and aggressive, and John trusted him.
When would I have to start?
Mr. Snow said. The day school gets out. After that, you report to me here every Friday morning at 9. John got to his feet and ambled to the door. As he was leaving the room, Mr. Snow said, You're welcome.
John closed the door behind him, but he was smiling.
The Friday morning Lionel, Mona, and the girls left in the limousine for LAX, John managed to look somber and contrite. He'd been excluded from the family fun, but he was taking his punishment like a man. Mona knew he was faking, but that was his intention. Lionel gave him a big hug, like there was oh so much affection between them. His dad patted his shoulder. You take care, he said. You have everything you need. Hot water would be nice.
Lionel frowned.
I thought we bought you a new water heater. I mentioned it to Mona after our last chat, but that was months ago.
I guess she forgot.
John's tone was neutral, and the gaze he fixed on his father was without guile. Lionel flashed an irritated look at her and then said, Call the plumber. Mona has the number in her Rolodex. Tell him we need an 80-gallon water heater, and the charge comes to me. The two of you can work out a time for the installation, but make it soon.
Thanks.
The minute the limo turned out of the driveway, John felt relief wash over him. It was like getting out of prison.
He loved having the big house to himself, though he spent most of his time in his rooms above the garage. The big house was pure Mona. Her taste, her style, expensive and overdone. He went through all her drawers but didn't learn much, except that she used KY jelly. Lionel had left him sufficient money to cover meals and gas for his motor scooter while the family was gone. In March, John had totaled the used car his dad had given him, and Mona was adamant about not replacing it. Fine with him. He went back to tootling around on the Vespa his dad had bought for him his freshman year. As the end of school approached, John asked if he could use his father's old Olivetti typewriter for summer school. But Mona said she needed it for one of the girls. John had to suppress a smile. When it came to sheer predictability, the amazing Mona was a champ. He cruised garage sales that weekend until he came across a Smith Corona portable electric typewriter with a manual carriage return. He paid $15 for that, and then stopped at the hardware store and bought 4 gallons of paint. For the 2 years he'd been living in his Aerie above the garage, he'd been content to leave it in its original bare and shabby state. Now he saw it differently. 3 dormer windows looked out on the ocean, and the sharply slanting eaves made the room feel garret-like, perfect for a writer in residence. He painted the walls a dark charcoal gray, close to black, in part to annoy Mona, but more nearly because it soothed and quieted the chatter in his head. He went through the main house, scavenging items from linen closets and storage areas. For bedding, he'd been using a sleeping bag flung on top of the bare mattress, but now he made up his bed with a set of Mona's expensive cotton sheets and 2 quilted coverlets his mother had made. From the attic, he brought down a second-hand chest of drawers and a hat rack. He mounted a series of wooden pegs on the wall for hanging his clothes. He scrubbed his small bathroom until it was immaculate. For the larger of the 2 rooms, he'd found a deep, down-filled easy chair, another garage sale acquisition, this one for $25, with a reading lamp thrown in. He moved his desk under the middle window, placed his typewriter in the center, and laid in a supply of paper, carbons, typewriter ribbons, and whiteout. Once everything was arranged, he sat there for 4 days, drinking coffee and staring at the view. During his preparations, he was brimming with ideas. Now that he was ready to go to work, his mind was a blank. He wrote the occasional paragraph, but he spent most of the time thinking about Walker. He couldn't figure out why Walker was so successful with girls, while he remained so out of it. Walker had had a string of girlfriends his senior year. 2 of them John found attractive, but neither one would give him the time of day. It was always Walker this, Walker that. Their only purpose in talking to John was to ask how Walker felt about them. Having heard Walker trash both in private, John wondered if they'd lost their tiny minds. Walker treated girls badly. He ignored or snubbed or insulted them. He'd date them, screw them, and break up with them. Given the tears and upsets and phone calls and public scenes, they were totally smitten, absolutely gaga about him. John detached himself, mystified by the unspoken rules underlying love, flirtation, passion, and sex. Just to feel like he was doing something, he went into his father's study and pulled out a copy of Hemingway's The Sun Also Rises. He took it back to his desk and typed out the 2 chapters. He liked the plain, choppy feel of the prose. But transcribing someone else's work didn't spark inspiration. While he liked the language, he wasn't connected to the content. The words belonged to Hemingway and the images were his. For John, the subject matter carried no emotional energy. If he could write about anything, what would it be? He couldn't think of a thing. He had to laugh at himself. He hadn't written a word, and he was already suffering writer's block. Just to shake himself loose, he closed up shop for the day and broke into a house four doors down. The owner was a Hollywood producer who spent the occasional weekend in Horton Ravine. John knew their habits because the couple had come to a number of dinner parties Mona had given, and they talked non-stop about themselves. The guy had a son John's age that John had no use for. Mona liked him, of course, because his manners were good, and he wore a coat and tie and said sir and ma'am. It was therefore doubly amusing to discover the